ويعلم ما في السماوات وما في الأرض والله على كل شيء قدير. يوم تجد كل نفس ما عملت من خير محضرا وما عملت من سوء تود لو أن بينها وبينه أمدا بعيدا ويحذركم الله نفسه والله رؤوف بالعباد. صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. Say, whether you hide what is in your heart or manifest it, Allah knows it. And He knows whatever is in the heavens and whatever is in the earth. And Allah has power over all things. On the day that every soul shall find present what it has done of good and what it has done of evil, it shall wish that between it and that evil there were a long duration of time. And Allah makes you to be cautious of retribution from Himself, and Allah is compassionate to the servants.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Iran's President, like Ebrahim Raisi, receives congratulatory messages from world leaders for winning the Friday presidential election. Iran summons the British ambassador to protest violent incidents targeting its expatriates voting in the presidential election. And India reports more than 58,000 new COVID infections. It's the lowest daily cases in nearly 3 months. Good day, everyone. Welcome to World News here in the Iranian capital. I'm your host, Behzad Zarifi. Good to have you with us. So let's start this bulletin with the latest updates on Iran's presidential election. Okay, Ebrahim Raisi has won Iran's 2021 presidential election by a landslide victory. The Muslim cleric has become the eighth Iranian president since the establishment of the Islamic Republic in 1979.
The short but intense presidential race in Iran came to an end on Saturday, with principalist flag bearer Ebrahim Raisi announced as the next president. Out of some 29 million votes cast in the election, Raisi secured more than 17.9 million votes to win the election by a comfortable margin against his reformist rival Abdel Nasser Hemati, who stood third in the race with less than 2.5 million votes.
Mr. Ebrahim Raisi is chosen by the people as the winner and president with 17,926,345 votes. Mr. Mohsen Rezai Miqad got 3,412,712 votes. Mr. Abdel Nasser Hemati, with 2,427,201 votes, is in the third place. Mr. Amir Hossein Ghazizadeh Hashemi, with 999,718 votes, is in the last place.
President-elect Raisi was the chief of Iran's judiciary from 2019 until he won the election. The Muslim cleric ran with the slogan of popular administration, Strong Iran, with a focus on uprooting corruption in the executive branch, fighting poverty, creating jobs, containing inflation, and housing prices.
I will make changes to the circulars that allow astronomical salaries for certain managers. This way we can help promote justice.
President-elect Raisi will take over power from outgoing President Hassan Rouhani with a host of unresolved issues. On top of them is an economy affected by the U.S. sanctions. That's in large part tied to the fate of the 2015 nuclear deal. On the campaign trail, Raisi stood out as an outspoken critic of Rouhani's policies. He believed that the ultimate cure for the economy must be explored inside the country.
Mr. Raisi comes from the principalist camp, which believes that any talks with the West must take place from a position of strength, unlike the weak stance adopted by the outgoing administration, which has made the negotiations erosive. Raisi would continue the Vienna talks, but he would tell the other side, hey, if you want a deal, let's have it. If not, we'll continue with our remedial nuclear steps.
Some 60 million Iranians were eligible to vote in this year's election. The Interior Ministry put the final voter turnout at 48.8%. The polls opened an hour earlier at 7 a.m. on Friday, and voting was extended several times until 2 a.m. on Saturday, both to accommodate the flow of voters and prevent the spread of the coronavirus.
Ebrahim Raisi has promised to recover the Iranian economy and strengthen it in the face of sanctions. Now it's up to him to make good on his promises and bring about the economic change that every Iranian is now hoping for. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Okay, now let's take a look at the president-elect's background and what he has promised to do in the next 4 years.
Ebrahim Raisi is a prominent Iranian cleric. He has held several key posts in the judiciary since 1979 Islamic Revolution. He was a prosecutor of the cities of Karaj, Hamedan, as well as the capital, Tehran. Raisi also served as first Deputy Chief of Justice of Iran and Attorney General. In March 2016, Raisi became the chairman of Astan Quds Razavi, and in 2019, he was appointed as a Judiciary Chief, a post he currently serves. In May, the prominent cleric announced his candidacy. He ran on a platform of tackling economic problems such as poverty, unemployment, and inflation.
My administration will have no red line in fighting corruption. The root cause of injustices in the executive branch of the government must be dried up. The banking, tax, import, and export systems must be reformed.
On Iranian economy, Raisi finds the current conditions unacceptable since people are not able to predict their financial situation due to constant fluctuations. He has unveiled a plan on economic recovery.
My economic plan can be summed up in three main points. Of course, there are other important issues I will address later if time allows. But now I would like to mention these three principles, which are the most important ones. The first one is overhauling governance and fighting corruption, inefficiency, and discrimination. The second point concerns supporting underprivileged families and social strata. And the third is increasing production and boosting businesses.
Regarding the 2015 nuclear deal, Raisi says he has set an agenda for securing the removal of anti-Iran sanctions. He highlighted the need for strengthening the economy in the face of sanctions or any other trauma that might afflict the economy.
The Iranian nation should do all in its power to confront those who seek to breach the Iranian nation's rights and pursue the removal of sanctions. Definitely, action should be taken to bring about the removal of the sanctions.
On foreign policy, Raisi has vowed to expand ties with countries across the globe, with neighbors to be given priority.
With your help and through strong diplomacy, we can establish good relations with the regional countries and raise the volume of our exports to the neighbors to the best level. We believe in interactions with the entire world in order to solve the country's economic issues, but the regional countries should be a priority.
Raisi has promised to define an important mission for Iranian embassy, that is to engage in economic diplomacy in respective countries. He has been elected as the 8th president of the Islamic Republic. He says people's trust in the administration needs to be restored.
President-elect Ebrahim Raisi has been congratulated by other candidates for winning the Friday vote. Mohsen Rezai, Abdel Nasser Hemeti, and Amir Hossein Qazizadeh Hashemi send congratulatory messages to Raisi, as final results put him well ahead of his rivals. Rezai said that the June 18th vote has once again proved the efforts of the Iranian nation in protecting and strengthening the security and power of their country. Hemeti expressed hope that the new administration would bring comfort and prosperity to the nation. Qazizadeh Hashemi appreciated what I call a massive and glorious turnout of vigilant and loyal people in Iran. Current President Hassan Rouhani also met with Raisi and congratulated him. He expressed gratitude for the people's participation, precision, and punctuality in the 13th presidential election. Meantime, several foreign leaders have congratulated Ebrahim Raisi. Russian President Vladimir Putin expressed hope for what he called further development of constructive cooperation between Moscow and Tehran. The presidents of Turkey, Cuba, Iraq, and Syria also congratulated Raisi on winning the vote. Pakistani Prime Minister called for more bilateral cooperation to boost friendly ties and security in the region. Leaders of a number of Persian Gulf Arab states, including Oman, Kuwait, and Qatar, are also extended felicitations. The leader of Lebanese resistance movement, Hezbollah, as well as Palestinian resistance movements, congratulated Iranian president-elect for the big win. Well, that was it for the election news. Now let's move on with the rest of this broadcast. Tehran has summoned the British ambassador to protest violent incidents targeting his expatriates who turned up at polling stations in the UK to participate in Iranian presidential election. The Iranian foreign ministry spokesman said that the violence was perpetrated by anti-revolutionary, anti-democratic, and terrorist elements insulting the voters and Iranian embassy staff. Said Khatibzadeh says that the incidents included a beating of a female voter in Birmingham. He said Iran would launch legal proceedings against those it holds responsible. Iranian media reported several incidents on Friday on the sidelines of the vote organized for Iranian citizens in Britain the US, Australia, and elsewhere. The remaining signatories to the 2015 Iran nuclear deal are set to hold a formal meeting in Vienna on Sunday. Russian envoy to talks, Mikhail Olyanov, made the announcement, noting that an agreement is within reach, but key differences persist. Iran and the other participants in the nuclear deal, also known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, are holding the sixth round of talks aimed at reviving the accord. The aim is to make practical arrangements required for the U.S. to return to multilateral nuclear deal. Iran wants all sanctions imposed by the U.S. after its 2018 withdrawal to be removed at once in a verifiable manner. Yemen's political leadership blames the United Nations for apathy toward the continued Saudi violations against Yemeni children. Officials say that the UN should play its role to lift the Saudi blockade on Yemen that causes more deaths among children instead of blacklisting the Ansarullah movement. Abdul Latif al-Washali has more.
Yemen's Ansarullah movement blamed the United Nations for the Saudi atrocities committed against Yemeni children. The movement said the UN has always been providing the political cover-up for the Saudi war crimes. This came after the United Nations added the Ansarullah movement to its blacklist for groups for violating children's rights.
We were not surprised by this decision because the UN had removed the name of Saudi Arabia from its blacklist of the groups violating children's rights. The United Nations have not taken any real steps to protect the rights of Yemeni children who die every day due to continued blockade on food, medicine, and fuel. I believe that this is a resounding scandal for the Secretary General of the UN, who began his second term with this decision.
The member of the Supreme Political Council, Mohammed al-Houthi, dismissed as baseless the UN accusation, saying it did not refer to an investigation on the ground as the movement has demanded. Meanwhile, the Minister of Information said the UN has turned a blind eye to the ongoing Saudi blockade on Yemenis, which causes the death of tens of Yemeni children on a daily basis.
This classification wasn't based on realistic data. We used to have the United Nations as a political cover for the war on Yemen and the killing of more Yemeni women and children, whether because of the continuous Saudi blockade or because of the airstrikes of Saudi fighter jets. This decision revealed to the world the true face of the United Nations, that it serves the agenda of the countries funding the UN.
Saudi Arabia and its allies launched a devastating war against Yemen in March 2015. The war has killed thousands of civilians, including women and children, and turned the war-torn country into the world's worst humanitarian crisis, according to the United Nations.
Observers say the United Nations blacklisting of Ansarullah is politically motivated and has no relation to the humanitarian situation in Yemen. They believe that the UN must take real actions against the Saudi blockade if it has real intentions to end the suffering of millions of Yemenis. Abdul Latif al-Washali, Sana'a.
Now let's take a look at some COVID news. India has registered its lowest daily cases in nearly 3 months. The country reported 58,000 new COVID infections in the past day, and that brings the caseload to 29.9 million. Fatalities hover around 387,000. The new daily infections in India dropped recently after a surge in April and May. Daily infections reached their peak of more than 400,000 last month. Strict lockdowns and mass vaccine rollouts have helped contain the surge. The country has the second largest caseload and the third highest death toll in the world. In Brazil, thousands of people have rallied across the country to protest President Bolsonaro's handling of the COVID-19 pandemic. Protests were reportedly held in at least 44 cities in 20 states. Demonstrators slammed the president for not acquiring vaccines fast enough and questioning the need for mask wearing. They accused the government of carrying out a form of genocide given the country's high coronavirus death toll. They called for the ousting of Bolsonaro. The rallies came as Brazil crossed the grim threshold of 500,000 COVID deaths. The country has also registered over 17.8 million cases. Brazil has witnessed the world's third worst outbreak, the second deadliest following that of the U.S. Shocking footage surfaced from the U.S. state of New York, showing a man chasing and trying to shoot three people, including two children. The video released by the New York Police Department shows a masked assailant to run up to a 24-year-old man on the sidewalk and shooting at him about a dozen times. The victim was shot three times in the legs and back, but is expected to survive. The two children miraculously escaped the incident unscathed. Police have asked the public for any information on the assailant and his getaway driver. The attack comes as shootings in the U.S. continue to claim more lives. More than 320 Americans have been killed in some 280 shooting attacks so far this year. Hundreds of French fishermen have staged a protest against offshore wind farm projects in the Normandy and the Brittany regions. Between 350 and 400 fishermen took part in the protests in France's Normandy. The protesters denounced the offshore wind industry's overreach. The fishermen demand an immediate halt to the construction work currently in progress. Protesters believe that the offshore wind turbines will change the ecosystems and the seabed, and as a result, the resources from the sea will decrease by up to 30%. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson is standing by his Health Secretary Matt Hancock after former aide Dominic Cummings leaked messages in which Hancock was described as hopeless in his handling of the pandemic by the Prime Minister. But the bitter infighting and war of words lays bare the chaotic nature of the Johnson administration as they battled the spread of COVID-19. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. The Supplication on Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary, O possessor of pardon and good pleasure, from wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From Thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From Thee
I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans. And I seek protection in thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For thou art Allah, the best guardian, and thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to thee, addressing myself to thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to you for the hope of your rewards. So bless Muhammad, the best of thy creation, the summoner to thy truth. Exalt me with thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely, thou art the all-forgiving, the all-compassionate.
The limelight.
Speaking in an interview with Fars News Agency, William Jones, journalist and political commentator, said, "The bitterness for so many Americans over the failure of the American dream has often been taken out on the latest category of immigrants, and this has led to heightened racial tensions, not only against American blacks, who have always been discriminated against regardless of how many generations their families have been here, but also against the latest batch of immigrants, now largely non-Caucasian." William Jones is a Washington bureau chief for the Executive Intelligence Review and a non-resident fellow of Chongqing Institute for Financial Studies, Renmin University of China. This interview is published under the heading U.S. Admins Promoting Hate Crimes Against Asian Americans. Stay tuned, please, for the details of this article. Speaking in an interview with Fars News Agency, William Jones, journalist and political commentator, said, "The hate crimes against Asian Americans has no doubt been promoted by the tremendous anti-China bias exhibited by both the Trump and now the Biden administrations. People do not understand China, and therefore they do not understand Chinese culture. It appears alien to many Americans. And unfortunately, the closing of the Confucius Institutes and the increased restrictions on Chinese citizens coming to the U.S. has inhibited Americans from acquiring a greater understanding of China and the Chinese. The gun culture in the United States of America is a perennial problem that is simply getting worse."
political commentator added, many people and many legislators have wanted to do things to restrict the proliferation of guns, in particular automatic weapons, with mixed results. The fact that the right to bear arms is in the U.S. Constitution also makes it difficult to make any sweeping changes in the legislation without changes in the Constitution, which would be a very lengthy and difficult process to accomplish, and probably a non-starter. But it would perhaps not have much of an effect on the number of hate crimes, only the way they would be perpetrated. This is more of a cultural and educational issue and would require improving the cultural and social climate in the U.S., as well as an improvement in economic conditions, which have deteriorated through the years, causing more hardship and bitterness among the American population. The journalist and political commentator added, the U.S. has traditionally always been open to immigrants. Nation of Immigrants has been its designation for many years. Yet, none of the immigrants have had an easy time with it, and integrating fully into U.S. society often took years, even decades, and usually only with the emergence of the second generation or third generation of those families. It has always been a fight for each new group of immigrants, and the ideal has often paled in the light of the reality. During recent years, the notion itself has come under direct attack. Part of this is due to the worsening conditions for the lower 90% of the population, and the bitterness for so many Americans over the failure of the American dream has often been taken out on the latest category of immigrants. And this has led to heightened racial tensions, not only against American blacks, who have always been discriminated against regardless of how many generations their families have been here, but also against the latest batch of immigrants, now largely non-Caucasian.
Voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Communicate.
Syrians have taken to the polls and re-elected Bashar al-Assad as president of the Syrian Arab Republic for a fourth consecutive term. With an extraordinary turnout rate and landslide victory, the West has actively sought to undermine the election and the will of the Syrian people. So what does this victory mean for Syria's 10-year resistance against regime change and against imperialism? And what tactics have Western nations resorted to in order to discredit and sabotage Syria's presidential elections? I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. On May 26th, 2021, Syrians took to the polls to vote in the second presidential elections since the start of the war on Syria in 2011. A month earlier, in April, 14 candidates had been approved to run by the People's Assembly. Bashar al-Assad, candidate of the Ba'ath Party, won in a landslide victory of 95.2%. The turnout was an astonishing 78.6%, which is very high under any circumstances, never mind for a country under siege. After the results of the elections were announced on May 27th, Syrians went out to celebrate, taking to the streets in droves. People all over Syria came out to celebrate with scenes of victory in Umayyad Square in the country's capital, Damascus. Scores of people poured out onto the streets of the port city of Tartus on the Mediterranean Sea, with similar images popping out from all over the nation. With a turnout rate of 78.6%, this is quite a remarkable feat. In European elections, the turnout rate is usually somewhere between 50 and 60%. The turnout rate in the 2020 presidential elections in the US was around a record-breaking 67%. The head of the Syrian parliament, Hamoud Sabah, announced the results of the election with around 14 million Syrians who came out to vote, which, given the situation of so many Syrians displaced by the war and the country still in turmoil, is very impressive. Now, before a single vote was cast, Western nations were already attempting to undermine the Syrian presidential elections. Several of them outright rejected the results in advance and proceeded to call the elections undemocratic. They claimed that the elections were illegitimate because they allegedly left many Syrians excluded. Ironically, these very same countries themselves prevented Syrians living abroad from even voting in the first place. For example, in Canada and Germany, Syrians were prevented from casting ballots at the Syrian consulate. These very same countries who pretend to be liberal democracies then turn around and deny Syrians the right to participate in their own presidential elections and prevent them from exercising their right to vote, which is a pivotal part of any supposed democracy. This claim that Syrians were purposely excluded was not just repeated by Western countries, but also by the opposition and opposition figures, which is all the more ridiculous given that the opposition, they are the ones who boycotted the electoral process, refusing to participate. In the northern city of Idlib, which is home to thousands of foreign-backed terrorists, of course it is not possible to partake in the election. The same rings true for the areas controlled by the American occupation and Kurdish forces in the northeast regions of Hasake and Deir ez-Zor, where they are busy plundering Syria's oil, of course.
We're keeping the oil. We have the oil. The oil is secure. We left troops behind only for the oil.
Now, in the media, the reporting about the elections has been abysmal. We have witnessed a concerted campaign by the corporate mainstream media to smear Syrians and their elections and to openly lie about the will of the Syrian people. Not one mainstream outlet in the West has even had any Syrian officials on to comment about the election, only opposition figures. The media have also resorted to talking about the staged Duma gas attack of 2018. This alleged gas attack was used as a pretext by the United States, Britain, and France to illegally bomb Syria. It was subsequently proven that this gas attack never took place, a false flag operation designed to blame the Syrian government as the Syrian army made its final push to take back the surrounding areas of Ghouta in the Damascus countryside. We have seen through leaked documents published by WikiLeaks that this gas attack never happened. The very same inspectors sent by the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, the OPCW, to investigate reported only trace quantities of chlorine, physical symptoms inconsistent with a gas attack, and ballistics showing the alleged gas canister to have been manually placed at the site. The inspectors concluded that given the lack of evidence, no gas attack had materialized and expressed concern after their findings had been removed. The OPCW's leadership doctored the reports of the fact-finding mission, removing key evidence in an attempt to cover up the truth and proceeding to smear its own scientists who blew the whistle. During this latest election in Syria, President Bashar al-Assad went to Duma to cast his ballot. The mainstream media used this photo op as an opportunity to revive the lies surrounding this staged gas attack and to attempt to smear the Syrian government and President al-Assad once more. Right now in Syria, many people are suffering due to the terrible economic situation and havoc brought on by sanctions imposed by the United States and the European Union. Universally, in almost every article and television report on the topic of Syrian elections, the mainstream media talks of the economic turmoil that Syrians are living through, without ever mentioning that this suffering, the long bread lines, the wait of almost 2 days just for fuel, is a direct consequence of Western sanctions. The media talk about Syrians living in poverty to illustrate the people's purported dissatisfaction with al-Assad, giving the impression that it is the fault of the Syrian government. First of all, this has nothing to do with elections. Second, this is not only untrue, but more importantly, it is a whitewashing of Western crimes. Syrians are suffering and starving right now precisely because of the West's foreign policy and imperialism. Yet this is rarely ever mentioned, if at all. If one wants a real example of propaganda, they need look no further than how the Western media reports on all matters related to Syria. It's frankly astonishing how anyone can make a report about the Syrian elections and not mention a simple basic truth that the majority of Syrians support Bashar al-Assad. If these so-called liberal democracies in Europe and North America care so much about democracy and the will of the people, why do they ignore this fact? It is incredible how not one report or article mentions this. The media call the elections a sham, but they talk about everything else without actually explaining why. They obfuscate and change the subject by mentioning the economic turmoil, but don't tell you that this is the fault of Western sanctions, and they try to make it sound like it's al-Assad's fault or the Syrian government is to blame. They talk about democracy, but don't tell you that the majority of Syrians support al-Assad, nor do they show any of the images of countless Syrians taking to the streets in a show of support and to celebrate his victory. They lie, they deny reality, and deceive to manufacture consent for regime change. That is what you call propaganda. Joining me is former British ambassador to Syria, Peter Ford. Thank you for your time. It's great having you on the program, Your Excellency.
It's a pleasure.
Ambassador, the British government, along with the Americans and others, they called the elections in Syria, quote-unquote, undemocratic and illegitimate. They outright rejected the results before the elections even took place. Could you give us an insight into what the motivations behind this are?
In a word, revenge. The Western powers, Britain and America in particular, are bitter because they have failed in their 10-year-long campaign to change the government in Syria. And they are therefore very bitterly disappointed because the recent elections served to underline their failure and to cement the position of President Assad in power. So what we heard was the sound, if I can put it this way, the sound of sour grapes.
So having been posted in Damascus and spent several years there, what do you make of the legislative and the electoral process in Syria?
Well, I don't think there can be any doubt that a majority of the Syrian people do not share the West's wish to get rid of President Assad. On the contrary, the president is seen by indisputably by a majority of Syrians as representative of stability. They do not, the Syrian people, without a shadow of a doubt, do not want to make a leap into the dark by getting rid of the president that they know. And when there is no alternative in prospect, who could unite the country, take the country forward in the next steps, rather the reverse. I'm quite sure that a majority, an authentic majority of the Syrian people have confidence in their president. They may grumble about the conduct of the government, rising prices, corruption, alleged maladministration, that sort of thing. Which country is free from such grumbling? Certainly not my own, the UK. And indeed, I believe that the level of support for the president is authentically well above the estimated 40% level of support enjoyed in the opinion polls by Boris Johnson and his government. I believe that the Conservatives or Labour would be absolutely over the moon to have the level of support that President Assad has.
When you say that Syrians don't want to take a leap into what is essentially the unknown, what do you think the alternative is? What is the alternative that the West is proposing to President Assad?
The West is always careful not to spell out, any alternative, because they know full well that the only realistic alternative would be a radical Islamist regime. They are totally irresponsible in wishing for what they call euphemistically a transition, which is translated means a regime change, but that phrase has had a lot of bad publicity, so they call it transition. They don't ever say transition to what, and there is no Nelson Mandela waiting in the wings in Syria. In fact, most Syrian people could not put a name on any Syrian opposition leader. I would be hard-pressed myself, and I'm a so-called expert. There are no plausible rivals, alternative political leaders to the president. There are warlords. There are warlords who, like such as those who rule the roost in Idlib province, who would undoubtedly, after fighting among themselves, inherit the crown in Damascus if the Western powers had their way.
In the early days of Tony Blair's government, the United Kingdom and other countries, they actually seemed to be or appeared to be on good terms with President al-Assad. I mean, what do you make of the current stance of the last 10 years from those in British politics and media who insist that Syrians are not deciding their own future and who've done this complete 180?
A lot of things have happened since those heady days in the early 2000s when Bashar al-Assad was having tea with Her Majesty the Queen in Buckingham Palace and was being seen as the new white hope and who was moving forward with liberalization of the economy in a way that was applauded in the West. And indeed, it was partly those efforts at liberalization by causing some suffering for the working classes in Syria and privileging of the middle class with this so-called liberalization. This was one of the reasons for the discontent which precipitated the uprising. But things have obviously moved on, and what Britain in particular cannot stomach is the fact that Syria has worked more and more closely with Russia and Iran, and therefore victory for Syria, victory for President Assad would be seen as victory for the leadership of Russia and Iran. This is something that the British government cannot stomach. So you have to see relations with Syria in the context of British relations with Russia and Iran. Poor old Syria is just the victim in the middle.
So just to wrap up, just as a last question, Ambassador, what do you think that al-Assad will do during his next term? What will be the next moves, do you think, from all these various governments that are trying to remove him and topple him? How do you see the rest of the war playing out?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, I think one of the options the president must be looking at is whether to make a move on Idlib, now that his hands are less tied than they were, although this is a difficult moment internationally in one way because of the ongoing negotiations between the United States and Iran over nuclear and sanctions, and I can see some argument for not rocking the boat in Syria before that matter is settled. But in due course, I'm quite convinced that the Syrian government will move to repacify the north east I can see increasing pressure on the U.S. Presence in northeast Syria. The tribes of that area, the Arab tribes of that area, are mostly very pro-Assad. They will not tolerate the Kurdish suzerainty which the American forces are imposing on them. But above all, I think the president will have his work cut out to cope with this continuing economic warfare. There is no doubt that it's the Western sanctions which are the biggest obstacle to Syrian reconstruction, and not just reconstruction, but even getting back a normal, ordinary life with availability of fuel and bread. I'm sure that will be the president's number one priority.
Ambassador Peter Ford, thank you so much for your time, Your Excellency. I'm very grateful for you coming on the program.
Thank you for having me, Richard.
We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
The countries that have rejected the election results in Syria, dubbing the elections undemocratic, they have been trying to push an agenda and topple the Syrian government now for over 10 years. They have no genuine interest in the will of the Syrian people. They are most concerned with enacting their foreign policy objectives in ensuring profits for their multinational corporations and in expanding their empires. This notion of calling foreign leaders illegitimate or calling elections undemocratic is a tactic often used by the West when talking about countries that they have an imperialist agenda in. We have seen the United States, Britain, and the European Union do the same thing with the Venezuela's presidential elections and its parliamentary elections, which we covered in late 2020 on this program. We have seen the West do the exact same to Evo Morales in Bolivia in late 2019 when he was overthrown by right-wing groups supported by the West. And in the case of Venezuela, this notion of legitimacy has also been used by the Bank of England as a ruse to steal over $1 billion in gold belonging to the Venezuelan people. The West loves to pretend that it has the moral high ground. They speak about Syria, Venezuela, and others as if they are colonies under their rule. This is a colonial mindset. Who are these countries to talk about rejecting the results of the Syrian elections? The results of the Syrian elections are for the Syrian people to decide, and Syrians only, not some men in Whitehall, Washington, D.C., or Paris. I find it incredible that the United States has the gall to lecture other countries about democracy when its own citizens are disenfranchised from voting. African Americans are still treated like second-class citizens, and Native Americans completely removed from any political capacity, wiped out through centuries of genocide. How can the United Kingdom lecture anyone about democracy when its judiciary is controlled by the United States, when it gives immunity to American spies who kill British citizens, or when Julian Assange is rotting away in Belmarsh prison for exposing the war crimes of the U.S. empire? Where is the respect for an independent press and fourth estate? The United States and Britain together have colonized and plundered the world for centuries. To this day, they continue to overthrow the democratically elected governments of Latin America, Central America, the Middle East, Africa, and Asia. They are the last people on earth to be giving lectures about democracy. The fact of the matter is, there has been a cold, calculated attempt to overthrow the Syrian government for decades. We know from General Wesley Clark that a neocon plan for regime change has been put in place during the Bush years, with Syria on the list of targets. We have seen the cables from the U.S. Embassy in Damascus already in 2006 about how best to exploit the weaknesses of Bashar al-Assad in order to destabilize Syria. The United States created al-Qaeda during the Cold War, then with Britain proceeded to help create ISIS through the invasion of Iraq in 2003. With their ally, life, such as Israel and Turkey, they have provided weapons, logistics, and assistance to terrorist groups inside Syria. And then the media tries to whitewash them as moderate rebels. Since the start of the so-called Arab Spring or uprising in 2011, they have been trying to topple the Syrian government and turn the whole country into another failed puppet state, as they have done to so many others. Through their imperialist greed, they have completely, utterly destroyed Syria. These actors do not have Syria's best interests at heart, nor do they care about the will of the Syrian people. Quite the opposite. What Syrians have done through these elections is reaffirm their sovereignty, cementing their stance against imperialism and against colonialism. The election results are not just a victory for President Assad, they are a victory for the Syrian people. Syrians have shown their resolve and their spirit to be unbreakable. Even after 10 years of war and all the suffering that has come with it, they have been unrelenting. Once again, they are showing the world that they will not allow others to dictate their political, economic, and social affairs. Syrians will not allow foreign-backed terrorists and militias, nor any other governments, to come in and tell them how to run their country. Syrians want a secular, stable Syria under Bashar al-Assad, which stands with the axis of resistance, which stands with Palestinians, which stands against imperialism, and guarantees a multi-ethnic, multi-religious, harmonious, and peaceful society for all Syrians. No matter what the media says, no matter how much propaganda they produce, and how much they try to sell regime change, Syrians are saying they will not be coerced or bullied into conforming to Western foreign policy objectives. Syrian matters are for Syrians only to decide. If President Bashar al-Assad did not have the support of the Syrian people, he could never have remained in power and withstood 10 years of war against him, and withstood 10 years of the United States, Britain, and Israel, and so many other countries and their terrorist groups trying to get rid of him. No one could. It's unconscionable to think that anyone could survive such a feat without the backing of their own people. Syrians have shown that they support their president and their government, both during wartime and in their elections. For anyone to deny this is simply to deny reality. It's not about one's opinion or what one thinks. This is about understanding the truth on the ground. We also have to look at this election through the lens of resistance. What Syrians do every day, what they have done for years, is resist imperialism through all means necessary. This huge turnout and landslide victory also symbolizes a victory for the axis of resistance as a whole. When we talk about the axis of resistance, we're talking about the nations that the West has tried to break and intimidate, such as Syria, Iran, Palestine, Venezuela, Cuba, Yemen, Lebanon, Iraq, North Korea. We have seen during this vicious war against Syria how the whole world rallied behind the U.S. empire and joined them in their regime change project. Very few stood by Syria's side and remained with the Syrian people. Iran and Russia have helped Syria to stay afloat and to resist this onslaught. When Syria was in its darkest hour and on the verge of falling into the hands of Daesh, they answered the call to aid. They stepped in to provide and help to prevent the unthinkable from happening. They have stood steadfast with the Syrian people, respecting their will and protecting their sovereignty from foreign aggression, both militarily and politically. The entire apparatus of the mainstream media continues to repeat the same lies about Syria in a multitude of languages and mediums. There is complete uniformity and hegemony between the corporate media and the foreign policy objectives of Western governments. Inextricably intertwined, these two institutions work in tandem, and everything they have reported on Syria for the last 10 years has been almost entirely propaganda, and the presidential elections of 2021 are no different. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
Federal meteorologists and climate experts say the potential for another devastating wildfire season is higher than normal for much of the western United States, where a brutal heat wave has shattered temperature records across multiple states. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Mike Ludwig Ryder. This article is published under the heading, 33 Wildfires Are already burning across 10 U.S. states. Stay tuned for more. Federal meteorologists and climate experts say the potential for another devastating wildfire season is higher than normal for much of the western United States, where a brutal heat wave shattered temperature records across multiple states recently. Nearly 90% of the West is experiencing drought, increasing the amount of fuel for fires, such as dead trees and brush that is drawing out up to a month ahead of schedule in many places, according to the latest climate update from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA. The past spring has been the warmest on record and the driest since 2006 in the lower 48 states. Drought conditions have only intensified during the latest heat wave. More than 40 million people experienced triple-digit temperatures recently, straining power grids in Texas and California and prompting officials across the Southwest to warn the public against walking dogs on hot sidewalks and spending time outside during the day. Wildfires are already burning across multiple states, including a massive 21,000-acre blaze in Montana, according to the U.S. Forest Service and news reports. With the start of summer right around the corner, the National Interagency Fire Center reported 5 new large fires recently, bringing the current total to 33 fires burning across more than 400,000 acres in 10 western states. Wildfires occur naturally and play an important role in certain ecosystems, especially in the West. However, climate change and disruption of natural areas caused by human pollution and development have created conditions for widespread and devastatingly intense wildfires. A landmark 2016 study found that human-caused climate change is responsible for 55% of the increase in dryness that creates fuel for wildfires, more than doubling the amount of land burned across the western U.S. over the past three decades. Last year, record-breaking summer temperatures, the fourth highest level of drought on record, an unusual amount of dry lightning combined to create apocalyptic fire season that saw 10.27 million acres of land burned, the most ever recorded according to Yale Climate Conditions. Millions of people in California, Oregon, and Washington were forced to evacuate from cities large and small as huge wildfires raced across landscape and sent enough smoke into the air to change atmospheric conditions across the nation. Gina Palma, a fire meteorologist with the U.S. Department of Agriculture, said scientists are currently observing drought conditions that they would not normally see, not in June, especially in the foothills of mountains and higher elevations across the West, increasing the likelihood of fires. Still, every fire needs a spark, and it remains to be seen whether lightning or fires started by people, for example, will spark the tinder available in brushy areas and dry forests and cause another intense wildfire season.